Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and today we will be talking with Kelly Diekman, the new Director of Planning and Housing for the City of Ames, about the direction of development in Ames and other planning-related topics.
So you have your growing edges of your neighborhoods, and then you also have reinforcement of neighborhoods in the center of the city, because I don't think we can leave the center of the city behind and keep looking just to the edges for new growth.
My conversation with Kelly was a follow-up to a show that aired about a month ago about the shortage of rental housing in Ames. In that show, I interviewed Vic Moss of the Emergency Residence Project, which has seen a steady increase in the number of families experiencing homelessness in Story County. Vic ascribes this in part to the dwindling supply of affordable and low-income rental units. Here's Vic from that last show.
Every community should simply have it etched in stone if necessary, so don't forget it, that the range of housing in their community should reflect the range of incomes, so that people, if they're good enough to work here, they're good enough to live here.
Organizing through AMOS, a Mid-Iowa organizing strategy, a group of concerned citizens, including myself, has embraced this objective and is seeking to gain the ears of council candidates, city and county officials, and our new Director of Planning and Housing, Kelly Diekman. I gave a copy of the show to Kelly and asked him to listen in preparation for our conversation. It is in this context that our conversation took place. This is Greta Anderson from Local Talk, and I am here with Kelly Diekman, our new Director of Planning and Housing in Ames. I've asked Kelly to talk to us about some of the issues about affordable housing that I brought up in a past show that really laid out the great shortage of affordable rental housing in particular. But first, let's get to know Kelly a little bit. Kelly, you're new to Ames. What made you want to apply here?
I was really interested in Ames for really two reasons. My family and I were looking for a more homey environment to move from where we were in California, more family-oriented community. And really, Ames was attractive because of the college. That just brings a different vitality to a community. And I saw Ames as a real vital community that has a sense of itself and wanting to do things and be active, and really a pleasant environment for all types of activities and people and things that were really of interest to me and my family.
Great. And why do you think you got this job? Why do you think you were selected of all the candidates?
Ames has an interesting approach to hiring people. They really have a commitment to the values of the people that they're hiring. They have a sense of pride in their employees, and the city manager's office looks at that through the whole organization, and they feel they have a responsibility to the community. So with that said, I think I was bringing the type of integrity and values to the organization that they were looking for, and on top of that, I had planning experience. From a planning perspective, I have a real broad background from doing new development project review, to doing environmental review, to doing long-range planning projects and policy planning. So I believe as a planning director, I bring all of those elements to the table.
Yeah, that's great, because we have a lot of people concerned about the environmental impact of different decisions. We have a lot of people concerned about the long-range growth of the city and where it's headed. So I can see that makes a lot of sense. Your background is in cities in Oregon and Silicon Valley, California. What experiences there do you think you might bring to Ames that would be new perspectives that would help move the city forward as it grows and changes?
One of the attractions to Ames was really I felt Ames is at a great point in their development of having a lot of opportunities in front of them. They haven't really set their course yet in exactly how they want to progress into the rest of this century. And that was very attractive to me. I think there's a lot of interest on different fronts for the community, and there is a desire to move ahead. And what I think I'm able to do is to bring some perspective on things I have seen done with communities that have progressed. Silicon Valley grew from small towns to a very urban area in a very quick time. That's not going to happen here, but there are issues of transition that I was familiar with. in my communities back there that I think Ames will see over the next 10, 20, and 50 years as well. So I think I am here to help guide some of those choices, because there is a big amount of change that's on the potential horizon here. And I think with my background of looking at how communities grow and develop, and not just how developments grow, I think I'm going to help the community look at how they plan to do things and how they are actually implementing these things as well. Some of the projects that we would look at is we would spend a lot of time on projects that were what we considered infill. We weren't growing anymore. We were bordered by every other town, so you couldn't grow out. Ames clearly has more land and is looking to expand their neighborhoods and meet needs that way. But I think there's a lot of introspective look back into the community too. And what are the things that we want to preserve in our community? What are the historic issues? What are the neighborhood issues that we have that we want to make sure that we protect and that we sustain? And it's not really protection. It's really sustain, because you want to maintain the character of the neighborhoods that the city's been built around. At the same time, we know that there's new things that are influencing the world today, new desires, new types of people want to come to the community, new generations. While we're looking inwards back to the downtown area, you look at Campus Town, you look at some of the neighborhoods in the core area, they have a lot of value in them because of their character, but they also have a lot of value in that they have a lot of opportunity to provide more interests, more uses, more people within the core of the city, and providing that diversity and that mix of people and uses throughout the community. Then, so you have your growing edges of your neighborhoods, and then you also have reinforcement of neighborhoods in the center of the city, because I don't think we can leave the center of the city behind and keep looking just to the edges for new growth.
In this context, Kelly brought up the development at the old Roosevelt School in Ames. Developer Dean Jensen purchased Roosevelt School earlier this year to renovate into condominiums. The school board's earlier plan had been to tear down this historic brick building and sell the land to a developer for single-family homes. This would entail the loss not only of a beautiful historical structure, but also of the school playground, which was used heavily as a park by neighbors, which was in fact a beloved community space, a community commons. The outcry of neighbors and developer Jensen's creative intervention allowed the building and part of the park to remain. It will also increase the density of this core Ames neighborhood. Here's Kelly Diekman's view of this development.
I think that's one of the best examples of how you can look at a community developing while maintaining the fabric of its neighborhoods. It's so important to maintain neighborhood fabric and integrity, and the Roosevelt Project is going to be exemplary for the city, in that the number of units there isn't something you can build from scratch, but because that structure is there and it has character, has historic attachment to it, those units are going to fit there and they're going to be a contributor to that neighborhood. And it's a much better use of the site to keep the reuse of that building and keep the site as it is than it would be to just tear it down and level it and then rebuild with things that we see everywhere else. So I believe it's going to be a win-win for the city on both the different type of housing that's going to be there as well as its ability to contribute to historic preservation and to the neighborhood.
Yeah, too bad we don't have more abandoned warehouses. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're talking to Kelly Diekman, the new Planning and Housing Director for the City of Ames. This show is part of a Local Talk series dealing with housing issues, particularly low-income housing. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and I come to this issue from an advocacy perspective as a member of the board of the local homeless shelter, where we've seen more and more families unable to find a place to live in Ames, and as part of an advocacy group, Amos, seeking ways to address this situation. Kelly Diekman comes to this issue having worked in Silicon Valley, where housing pressures are even more intense. In a previous show, I interviewed Ron Hallenbeck, the Vice President of the Ames Chamber of Commerce,
to find out what local businesses are saying about Ames's housing stock. Here's a snippet of that conversation.
What we hear from the companies coming in from out of town is if they're going to come and they want to develop their business right here in Ames, they want their employees here in Ames. And they're saying that they're finding it harder and harder that we have enough housing of all different kinds, low to, you know, more expensive.
The show also explored the increasing enrollment at Iowa State University and how that is affecting the Ames housing market. Just a few statistics. In 2010, enrollment at ISU was almost 29,000. The next year, 30,000. 2012, 31,000. And this year, we have an estimated enrollment of 32,000 students. That's an increase of 1,000 students over each of the last 4 years. This August, ISU made national news by offering returning students $1,000 not to live in the dorms. Of course, those students must live elsewhere in the community, and that means more pressure and stress on Ames's housing market. Yet as of this summer, Iowa State had no immediate plans to build new dormitories. Remember that even if it did, it would be 2 or 3 years before a substantial new residence hall would come online. Here's part of a conversation I had with Director of Residence Pete Englund.
What about this notion of a bubble? Are you afraid that this is a bubble? I understand that the President, Stephen Leith, has ambitions for ISU to continue to grow. Are you concerned about a bubble, or are you planning long range for more housing on campus?
Well, it doesn't hurt for us to think forward about possibilities. It's either if we sustain these kinds of classes, do we see some reductions, what would we do? The other part is if we continue to see the kind of growth and enrollment or experience consistent enrollment like this, we need to provide more housing on campus.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. We return now to my conversation with Kelly Diekman, the new Director of Planning and Housing in Ames.
Let's turn to the topic of low-income and affordable rental housing. This is not a topic that has gotten a lot of attention over the years, but you've listened to the Local Talk show we did on the rental housing crisis in Ames. Was there anything there that surprised you?
A few things did strike me as being of interest. What really struck me was that there is a demand for basically everything in the city, whether it's affordable housing or single-family homes or student housing. That really struck me as a need. And one of the new things for me to learn as I've come to Ames is the demands or the pressures of the student housing component on development. That's something that I'm becoming more and more aware of, and it also came up in the broadcast you did about housing and its influences on the ability to find rental housing for a variety of types of people.
Yes. A population of any town is going to have its ebbs and flows, but the student populations really heighten those flows. We haven't seen many ebbs lately, but it's a problem. Since I did that show, I've talked to a number of people who have been looking for housing, rental housing in Ames, and simply can't find it. We here in Ames, who are focusing on affordable housing as an objective that we hope the city and the community will embrace, feel that, you know, this is a severe problem in Ames. Do you think it is severe all over the country?
It varies by region. Different regions pay different attention to different issues. And my professional impression is that the Northeast on the East Coast and then again on the West Coast, this issue is dealt with more than it is in the center part of the country. Part of it is just the high level of density of development, and the issue of housing is more obvious when you're living in that type of an environment. But it also comes from grassroots people trying to push issues forward that are of social issues to people as well. In my background in California, it's twofold that really has made this an issue that comes out throughout the planning processes out there. One is the state has made it an issue. The legislature and the governor have signed a number of bills and created a number of organizations that focus housing issues at the state level, at the county level, and at the local level. locally in Silicon Valley, the industry groups there saw it as a major issue to support the economy in the Bay Area was to have a variety of housing types. The commute patterns of in commuting to Silicon Valley for jobs are tremendous. The amount of time you take to travel everywhere and the costs, that was an issue to them. They were concerned about the welfare of their workers and the ability to get productivity, again, back to economic benefit to everybody. And they saw housing as a key issue in attraction of new employees and retention of employees.
In a sense, we should feel very lucky that we don't have those problems. I can't even imagine commuting for an hour, much less two or three. I complain about my 10-minute commute and plan my days so that I don't have to come in every day. But it is a situation, nonetheless, on a much less intense way here in Ames, where people who work in a lot of the factories here commute from out of town.
And I would say the trend in planning is a very broad field that deals with physical development to social issues as well. So within the field, it's a high demand issue. And what a lot of the concepts are is that while it may be a goal to house everyone in your community, the recognition is there. Really, it's about choice, and you want to make sure the choices are there for people that do want to live in the community. So a lot of planning professionals are looking at providing for the options and the choices of people choosing to live where they want, and not preclude someone from being able to come into a community or live in a community where they work or where they desire to live. So the planning profession overall, it is something that gets addressed both academically as well as in practice. As an issue of choice, there's multiple facets to that in terms of development types and financing issues. There's a lot that goes into that, but a lot of times it comes down to finding ways to have choices for people to fit what fits their family, what fits their needs.
In the story I did, there seemed to be a lot of talk about people who had no choice. But it's interesting that you say California has some laws set up that require development of low-income housing. Can you talk a little bit about those?
So California would look at this as both an incentive-based program, also a regulatory-based program. They had set up financial resources to encourage and really help affordable housing be built at different income levels. At the city level, though, development regulations could be enacted by cities that would require a certain percentage of development to be dedicated as affordable housing. And that could be either a rental unit that's dedicated for a certain number of years to low-income households, or maybe even in a for-sale project, it would be targeted to a different income level, maybe moderate income, and again be deed restricted to have to be someone occupying that structure that is at a certain income level, regardless of the market rate housing around it. So some communities would do that. It wasn't always the choice of a community. There's different strategies to addressing things. Some communities look to construct housing and to control housing themselves rather than put it into the development market as a way of providing for that housing stock. But some would say, well, in addition to what we're doing, we would like to see development take on a share. One of the challenges with the approach of including the mandatory components in development is that there is a lot of legal requirements that goes into it. To justify this type of regulation, you have to go through a process that's called a nexus study, and you have to do a lot of analysis to justify what an impact of new development is on a housing supply. So when these regulations are adopted, they're to address new impacts. They don't usually go retroactively to existing problems. So it helps to minimize the effects of new development, but really cities still have to grapple with existing housing problems they may have had before any development came to town or more development came to town. It's more of a long-term strategy because you have to build a housing stock over time to address it. It doesn't really provide an immediate solution in year one of establishing such a program.
I see. So if you had a rule of 10% or 20% of new houses or units had to be low income, if you only had 50 new houses built that year, you'd only have 5 to 10 structures. Do you think there might be a role in Ames for government-partnered affordable housing construction?
A lot of times when it comes down to financing affordable housing projects, it's really a conglomeration of a lot of resources at different government levels. Cities get financing most often from the federal government through different federal programs. One of the ones that the city has is Community Development Block Grant Funds, CDBG funds, and they have to be spent in census areas that have low-income housing. And they're for physical, they're for projects. They could include infrastructure, but it could also include purchase or development of homes as well. Just recently, the city's used some funds to buy foreclosed houses that were really kind of a blighted situation in a neighborhood, and have gone in and rehabbed them and then resold them to targeted income of moderate income people to then take that house after it's been rehabbed. So it's an occupied house, and now it's contributing to the neighborhood. And that's the intent of that program, is to both help low or moderate income individuals, but also to stabilize or to reinvest in a community at the same time. Then there's other programs that are more human service or social service based, to try and help with maybe down payment assistance or short-term loans for down payments on a house, buyer education, renter education, just to help with the aspect of financing it on an individual level. Other communities can also look to try and gather resources to maybe help fund an affordable housing project. That's usually a local decision to want to use some of their general fund, or to use some other kind of fee that they may generate to try and subsidize the development of affordable housing projects. Affordable housing projects are extremely difficult to finance. The margins are difficult. They're competing against the regular market-based projects that are out there, so they don't get discounts on land or discounts on building materials or anything like that. So they're approaching it from a different perspective, and it is a big challenge, even if you can find an affordable housing developer, to put the right financing package together, whether it involves local money or whether it involves federal money.
I think I've heard that the era of project housing is kind of over, that, for instance, Section 8 is now focused much more on the voucher system, which is a portable system. Low-income people just have to find a landlord who will take their voucher, instead of a project-based one, such as Eastwood on 7th Street here in Ames.
The federal government department that administers most of the federal money is HUD, which is the Housing and Urban Development. In the past, they had the reputation of building the large, concentrated projects, just not even the Section 8 process, but just building those large projects. They've turned away from that. They realized that concentration was not a solution. Just because it was efficient was not a good way of contributing to a community. So they're looking at projects that have a diversification of income levels and socioeconomic levels. If they're looking at large projects to fund, they want to build more neighborhood scale projects as well, which is very important to a town like Ames that isn't looking for large high-rise projects. They're looking for scaled development that fits in its surroundings. So HUD has seen that as a better approach. They don't tell local governments how to use their funds necessarily. There are program guidelines where you have to follow it, but it doesn't say you have to build this or build that. But they all also are looking at, as you mentioned, with the Section 8, it is a way of diversifying and spreading out the use of affordable housing funds to different places in a community and different places in the county as well.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Greta Anderson, talking about affordable housing with Kelly Diekman, the new Director of Planning and Housing in Ames. Well, our conversation here was getting a little abstract, so I wanted to propose a real-life scenario to Kelly and see what he thought.
The feds repossess my pretty home. My lady wanted money, so I'm alone. Mobile home, mobile home, mobile home.
Trailer parks were on my mind. For one, we had just heard about the city's rezoning of the land on Lincoln Swing where a trailer park sits. People I know knew people who had waited a long time to find affordable housing and had only recently found it there, in the Lincoln Swing Trailer Park. Now they had only 6 months to move. Also, I've been hearing Vic Moss talk a lot about trailer parks and the role of these developments in providing people affordable housing. Here's Vic on the last show.
New developments go into where the property is the cheapest. They go into where trailer courts are sitting because it turns out the land is worth more than the trailers. And that's what's happened in Ames. We've torn down one after another. More than half in the last 15 years have disappeared in Ames, where hundreds and hundreds of families could once live. And these were the places that families used to go once they left our shelter. You know, with a mobile home, if they got even a minimum wage job, they could sometimes afford that, you know, and stay there. And I felt really good about that.
And finally, well, I mentioned that commute I have. It happens to pass right by some land for sale on Dayton Avenue, just north of the Pizza Ranch there on 13th. Every time I see that land and those signs, I think of what Vic says about trailer parks. I see the industries nearby, the fast food joints providing the lowest of wages to people, and I wonder, why not open that land to a trailer park instead of more businesses? So I asked Kelly about that idea as a kind of thought experiment on the topic we were exploring.
What would be preventing the institution, if someone desired to, of a trailer park in that setting where workers could be so close to the industries that they serve and also close enough to amenities, close enough to sewer lines and water mains and things that they would need to be served?
This question really comes down to what are the basic building blocks of planning and zoning for Ames. With all uses, the city has different zoning areas that have prescribed standards or rules for them. And those uses, are sometimes they're mixed and sometimes they're not. Mobile home parks, for example, are more of an exclusive use. They're pretty much a unique use. You don't mix other things in typically. In this particular case, or just any other area on the edge of the city, as you brought up, the most likely reason why something like that wouldn't occur would just be the market itself. It would need to be annexed to the city. And once you are annexed to a city, most people would say the value is in doing a different housing type. It's required to be annexed to the city because you're required to have city services to support any new development that's out there. And the city would require you to be annexed. You just can't do sprawl or leapfrog development outside of the city just because it may be easier, convenient for that one particular property owner. And in most circumstances, if you wanted to develop at a level of density where mobile home parks are usually built around 10 dwelling units an acre, they would probably find greater value in building a different housing type. So it'd be outcompeted in the market to build a townhouse or an apartment complex.
Are you speaking of the interest of Ames in wanting to have higher properties so that they can get more taxes, or are you speaking of the desire of the landowner who is selling the land to the developer?
The city of Ames is typically looking at its ability to provide services. And what I was saying they in that past example, it's really the property owner slash developer is looking at what profit they can make. And the easiest route to develop something and ensure that they're going to stay in the black at the end of the process. Developers are very risk adverse. They like to do what they know how to do. So if they feel that a mobile home park was a profitable venture, they would be at our door asking to do that. And the city would be reviewing it for conformance to its requirements and really how it fits into the community. Because we really don't like to look at a project in isolation. Like I said, we don't want to just have a housing project of any type just pop up a half a mile outside of the city. That doesn't really help the city in the long run of building out its facilities and providing good services and providing for cost-effective services, which comes back to your question about taxes. The issue of taxes from one user to another isn't typically part of the evaluation. It's really just about how does it fit into the plan. In the case we brought up Dayton, it's not planned to have housing out there. It's planned to be for jobs. But in other parts of the city where housing is anticipated, it would come back to the same conversation of what's the most desirable use from the landowner and the property owner's perspective.
Okay, I want to still play the devil's advocate here. In a larger sense, when you're thinking of cost, if workers can walk or ride their bike to their workplace, there would be some kind of savings. There would be some kind of benefit overall to our community.
There's a lot of different things that go into trying to prioritize the decision-making process for any use, whether it's for housing or an industrial development. I would say, practically speaking, it's very rare that you see any city mix residential with industrial, just because of compatibility issues. And while providing additional housing stock is a concern or an interest, you do have the long-term issues of social justice that kind of come into play about how are you disenfranchising someone in the long term by disassociating them from the rest of the community. Usually industrial areas are not integrated into neighborhoods for good reasons. And if you're putting housing just because you can into those areas, the long term, it's probably not really a good sustainable neighborhood. It's important to add housing stock, but it's also very important for a city to have neighborhoods that are sustainable. When a neighborhood is not well maintained, has a sense of pride, a sense of ownership, it really becomes a difficult area for a city to invest in and see it thrive. The amount of resources cities put in to reestablish neighborhoods is tremendous, and the city would want to see that not happen under in a new development scenario if it can. That's one of the interests in zoning, is to try and ensure property values and vitality. So while it may address one goal of an easy way to provide housing stock, a lot of times that idea of let's put in the housing right next to something that's less desirable, therefore it's more affordable, really has long-term implications in planning that we try to avoid. And I would say most communities do not address housing that way, where they try to just find easy, cheap areas to put housing because of those types of conflicts and long-term issues that arise from that. But the idea that we want employees near work is definitely part of Ames's philosophy. It's a fundamental goal of within planning, is to provide access to jobs, provide access to services, provide access to public facilities. So the city of Ames has a very difficult development pattern, with ISU being in the middle of it. It's on one side, it's a huge source of jobs, and we all have access to the middle of Ames. So from that sense, as the largest employer, there is a great availability of people getting to work that way. But when you look to the areas around Dayton and then to the south in the Research Park area, that's where most of our employment base is for the industrial and the office and those areas. And we have some limited growth in that direction. What we've seen is it's been harder to get developers to acquire property down there. And for whatever reason, there's been less willing sellers. So you're having a difficulty of building out a housing supply on the south end of town, which would have very convenient access to work and be in a different environment and have access to Highway 30 and to Interstate 35 for other commuting options. So the city's had a longstanding goal of seeing the southwest part of the city develop, recognizing it has great access to Iowa State, great access to the jobs on the south part of the city. It's just been unavailable for the city to see that vision. So we've seen other areas of the city develop instead.
You mentioned, you know, social justice issues and how those are written sort of into code. And I think there's a lot of that in Ames to ensure that rental housing is safe and clean and attractive and all of the things that will presumably help the renter as well as the rest of the community. And yet sometimes when you talk to developers, the code sounds very oppressive, that the code is what is driving up the cost of rental housing.
Right. So the general approach to zoning or to controlling growth in a community is based in the idea of you have governmental powers for health, safety, and welfare. General welfare, and those are evident in however you write your zoning codes, whether it's a setback from a street or from another house. I mean, as you brought up, we have a rental code where we're trying to protect tenants from possibly unsafe housing. At the same time, that's maybe seen as an impediment because landlords have to reinvest in their structures and bring things up to code at times. And there's a push-pull on that. Is, you know, what's the equity there? Is it a tenant right, or is it a lower cost of housing if you don't make those improvements? So there's a push-pull on that for sure. The city of Ames doesn't really have what I would say development standards that necessarily raise the cost of development. It doesn't have outlandish requirements for really large streets and expansive sidewalks and just things that are really large and take up a lot of space or cost a lot of money. I would say we're pretty standard in how we look at our layouts of subdivisions, and the same with our apartment dwellings and our development of high-density housing. We have, I would say, a pretty standard way of reviewing and looking at those. Within that, that's within the planning environment. There's also the building code, which is administered by the Building Inspections Division. And that code is always about the safety and the welfare of an occupant of a building. And those codes get updated too. And as we gain in knowledge of what's good and what's safe, those codes get updated too. I mean, we didn't used to require fire sprinkler systems in apartment complexes. Well, that's a pretty good life safety tool to have for long-term health and general welfare of your community. So now apartment complexes frequently will have a fire sprinkler system. So yeah, that's an additional cost, but that was something that's also for the benefit of people as well. So there are always things that raise costs, but there is a trade-off of the value that's been given back to the community or to an occupant or a tenant or a future owner.
The one that jumps to mind is the requirement for one parking space per apartment bedroom, which is obviously a code that came into place because of the student population.
So Ames is heavily influenced by our student population on every level, and it definitely has seeped into our zoning codes here. Most communities wouldn't have a parking standard of one per bedroom, but the way the student population lives, it was something that was seen to be a community value, that the neighborhoods weren't overpopulated by students and by vehicles being haphazardly parked in different areas, and just maybe a general sense of being unsafe or cluttered environment or something that wasn't really a typical standard neighborhood look. So the city did establish that parking requirement in response to community interest to preserve neighborhoods and to have some level of control on how student populations interacted with the community. A lot of communities will have a means to encourage affordable housing by having a flexible zoning standard, where if a project's volunteering to be an affordable housing project, they could ask for special dispensation on certain issues. And parking is the most frequent one that's requested. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. One, parking is expensive, so removing that cost makes things affordable right away. And secondly, usually the clientele or the future tenant or occupant of that affordable housing structure is very unlikely to own multiple cars. So with those two factors in consideration, communities often will relieve a parking requirement to try and support affordable housing projects. And usually that's through an individual request of a permit or something. That way you can deal with the uniqueness of the project as it comes in and still maintain what generally is good for the community for addressing the high density and the parking and the students in a bedroom situation. But that's a good example of how a community could help development of affordable housing. That's what's one of the biggest incentives and one of the most sought out incentives from affordable housing projects is the reduction in parking.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're talking to Kelly Diekman, the new Director of Planning and Housing in Ames. Later in the hour, the conversation turns to the needs and wants of the younger generation and planning for bicycles and walking as key means of transportation.
Gotten to the big question, and that is, how else can communities approach or address the difficulty in getting affordable housing built in their towns?
Usually when we're talking affordable housing, we're talking about how can we address low or extremely low income housing and people that are challenged in the economic environment to really have a sustained or stable housing environment just because of their being outcompeted. And typically that's through rental housing projects. As we mentioned at the very beginning, I believe we talked about whether you could mandate including affordable units within developments. Some cities have done that, even in California, where it does happen. It's not prevalent everywhere. It's a difficult choice to make for a community because there are a lot of resources that go into it, and it is tough to administer as well. Other things you can do is look at zoning rules, like we just talked about for parking. Are there ways to allow for different configurations, things that are more efficient? Maybe allow for smaller units, allow for more units on a site, because you are trying to either serve a smaller household size, or it is a family that doesn't need as much parking. Maybe it's a single parent household where, again, so there's different ideas about how you can create zoning standards that would be more adaptable or more encouraging of a variety of housing types. And really, again, it's good for our zoning to allow for choices of housing, so you can look at different levels and not just focus on one. If you start to focus on one and not pay attention to the different levels of housing, you're going to still have a problem. You're not really going to solve everything for everybody ever, but you need to have a broad-based approach, because year by year it will change somewhat. There's always going to be a need at the low level. There's always going to be a need at a moderate income level, and there's always going to be the desirability of home ownership. But it's still going to be a choice of some person's life, whether they're still comfortable wanting to rent versus trying to reach and get into a single family home or into a condominium as a more affordable option as a way of entering the housing market.
So you've mentioned policy and zoning issues. Could all of those things be part of a land use policy plan, an updated land use policy plan?
I think the concerns I've heard, especially in your first broadcast, was what I've coined as choice, but as what some of the other ways of saying it was, the ability to house all types of people within the city, whether if they work here and they choose to want to live here. So to take those kinds of ideas, how do you embody that into a zoning or into a policy plan of the city? It is possible. The land use policy plan is really our goals and policies that guide our decisions and how we do broad-based decision making for zoning and land development. The city council can amend or adopt a new plan and when they feel there's a need to. If you're looking at a full update of a plan, it's very reasonable to look at what the housing issues are when you're doing that. In the past, you may have just looked at new development issues, but you may also have neighborhood preservation issues that come into the conversation of housing. Affordable housing would come into that conversation of housing. Diversity or variety of housing types also come into that. What are the best locations? How do we serve those populations? What other community facilities will we need to bring into an area if we choose to grow in a particular area? All of those are housing-related issues, and at some level they're going to affect affordability and desirability, which are both very critical to the city. So a land use policy plan easily can have a goal about diversity of housing stock. It can have goals about meeting the needs of a variety of income levels. And from that, you would make decisions over time on how to implement that. It may create a new zoning district that allows for a certain type of housing type more easy than in another area. It could be a long-term goal of building a support for different nonprofit agencies. It could be beyond just, we have a limited set of what we look at. The city council looks at policy issues from a variety of angles, whereas we're looking at it through the development lens here. But the land use policy plan does set a tone. It does set a sense of what's important to a community. It is an appropriate issue to have in a land use policy plan when you're looking at all of the issues that affect a community. It's going to be very critical to the city to have that housing available. We want to thrive. We want to grow. We want to see our business environment succeed as well. There's a reason why we're desirable. We've done a good job of planning for our community, maintaining our community, and investing in our community. And going forward, we're going to have to do those same things for people of the next generation to have the same sense of pride and value for our community that we've had.
Wow, that was such a nice oration. but I think that things have changed, actually, in the last 15 years in terms of demographics, with just the general trends of employment and wages being so stagnant, and while the cost of living continues to rise. Does our current land use policy plan have language in it about affordability?
We don't have the real precise targeted goals and policies about really addressing affordability at a very specific level. It's more in a general sense of housing availability and things of that nature. The land use policy plan was adopted in 1997. And we think back to the mid-90s. It takes a long time to develop one of these plans. They don't just get done in a couple of months. So it takes a couple of years of development and community outreach and really getting the opinions and the interests of a whole community when you're doing a land use policy plan update. So when we go back to thinking about what things were like in the mid-90s, the amount of things that have changed just technology, just the idea of the internet and the access to different resources, where you can work, what you even work on now, the growth in ISU influencing our community. And that's even before you get into the generational changes. Just the different age groups now have much different interests in how they want to live or how they choose to live than really what the pattern might have been for 30 years of how suburban development was done. So when you look at that, it's got a really sound base to it. It has a lot of goals and ideals in it right now that have served the community well, and they would probably still be in a plan that's updated. But there are maybe new issues that could be added as well, or different perspectives that are really now, 20 years later, more relevant to people than they would have been back in the 90s.
Yeah, I think especially about the car issue, with so many young people now really preferring not to own a car and to be able to walk to their jobs or the amenities that they need.
Yeah, that's a national trend. And I think it's really, you might see it, you might not feel it here, but you would see it here if you really started to look into the student population. The amount of car ownership and usage among students would probably be lower than it was in the past, but there's more of them, so you don't really feel a change. But on a national level, that is absolutely true. The millennial generation and the generations under that are deferring getting driver's license. It was a rite of passage maybe when we were younger to get that driver's license and get out there and have the freedom to do things. Younger generations are seeing that a little bit differently. They have other interests they want to pursue. They want to put their money towards something other than maybe owning a car, or they're delaying that, trying to do other things with their time or with their money. And that's a national trend, and it's gonna be prevalent in Ames in the next few years if it isn't already, and it's gonna continue in most likely for the near future just because the availability of information and the access and transportation, as we've all seen, has gotten more expensive than it was again about in the mid-90s, which was probably about the cheapest transportation we would have ever had in recent past as well. So the idea of transportation and access is one of those driving factors when it comes to planning. That's always a good thing to look at when you're trying to plan new areas. What's the ability to provide transit? How do you have bicycle access? Is it trails? Is it lanes? What are the sidewalk availability for you to be able to do some of your trips? Again, it comes back to options and choices. Really, what we've seen in the field over the last 30 years, the more options and choices you have, the more the spread is in the interest and the availability to meet different needs throughout the community and not just focus on one thing. And in the transportation area, you're never going to get people out of their cars on an everyday basis. Some people would choose to live that way. But what you're really trying to do is reduce the reliance on the automobile. You can choose to walk and get your groceries if that's your choice, because it's either good exercise or because it's more affordable to you, or you just want to be outside because you enjoy being outside. If you're isolating neighborhoods and you're just forced to drive, that's just a cost that you incur as well as the lack of an option in your life. So when we're looking at planning for new neighborhoods, we want to see the ability to do a lot of different things, to have good access, and whether it's bike, walk, take transit, or drive. You don't limit one of those necessarily.
That brings us kind of back full circle to the infill issue that we already touched on. And how do you kind of get developers to keep pace with these trends and explore new ideas? You know, do our developers need to be educated? Do we need to invite other developers in to do some of the more innovative things that would really benefit the community?
The development community is a very fragmented industry. They usually specialize in one thing. They really don't venture into trying to do multi-story structured parking projects. That's usually a specialty developer. Since we don't really have a pattern of that in the city, we do have a few. It would most likely would require or be of interest to someone that's from outside of the community, because they would have had experience doing these projects. Now, we do have some examples of those. And what we've seen is a lot of where we've seen national builders come in. One thing we don't have in Ames is really the single-family suburban national builder coming in. which would not necessarily be a benefit to the city, because that is a cookie cutter model that we don't really have here. Our local developers are doing a little bit more customization into their projects than what you would get with a national builder. But trying to pull someone from a single family development model into a high rise multifamily or into a structured parking environment, that's highly unlikely to happen. It's just a different type of economics and building expertise and everything like that. So when the city looks at what they can do to try and provide for a different housing type, we can encourage things through incentives. The Roosevelt Reuse is a great example. A local developer wanted to take a risk on that, and the city recognized the probable value in that project, and they were willing to support that with a tax abatement project. So those types of tools might encourage other people to come to the city if you have good planning that allow for that to be built in the first place, so they're not having to go through the fight or the argument of changing something to allow for it to be built. That's very draining on a developer. If the city knows what it wants and it can create the zone for it or the place for it in advance, that really helps put development in the right place, and it encourages and streamlines that process for the developer, saving them time and money, which might make it more financially feasible. A lot of times it really does come down to economics. The bigger projects are higher risk and more complicated, and they are fewer and far between in every city. It's not just Ames. Ames will see its share over time, but it's an issue across the country of how does the housing market catch up with demands at different levels. And there's a good strong segment that want to see maybe condominiums that are available to them as a smaller house that's available to them. But there's also always going to be a strong segment that wants to see a single family detached home. So it's again a diversity of housing and a lot of options, and different developers meet different interests. And that's how that industry really works.
Is it within your ability as the planning team employed by the city to propose a change of zone prior to someone asking for it? Usually it seems like it's always the developer asking for a change of zone, but if you envision a project for perhaps higher density in the core town, is that something that you can do proactively and thereby attract developers?
The planning department really takes its direction. The city council sets its work plan out for our staff. We don't have the initiative to just start working on something that we think would be of interest. We can propose ideas for our work plan in advance and have the council look at that. One example, though, that has been done in the city is that South Lincoln area. The city did win an award for that plan. It allows for the transition of that neighborhood to include office uses or small apartment buildings and still have a certain character to it. So that was done by the city with a specific purpose of trying to guide small businesses into an area. So they wrote a new plan and a new zoning district to try and facilitate that happening. So yeah, the city has done that before. And it has to be more of a desire of the community. And if there's a need for it, the city council will ask us to do it, and we'll take on that project and do what we can to research the issues and bring that forward for a decision to the city council on what some of the pros and cons of doing things certain ways are, or if we really know that's what we're committed to doing, we'll come ahead with standards for how that could work well for the city.
Okay, well, I think I've taken enough of your time. You've been very gracious and obviously interested in listening as well as talking. So thank you very much. And I'm somewhat humbled by the complexity of what you are having to deal with to be a good planning and housing director.
I thank you for taking the interest and taking one of the issues that we hear about and wanting to discuss it and try and develop the ideas and get into education around the issues more. And I'm very happy to have spent my time with you all.
That's it for this week's Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, and we've been talking with Kelly Diekman of the City of Ames. We also heard from Vic Moss of Emergency Residence Project, Ron Hallenbeck of Ames Chamber of Commerce, and Pete Englund of the Department of Residence at Iowa State University. Music we heard included two tracks by Daft Punk from their recent album Random Access Memories, Our House from the British group Madness, and Mobile Home by the Ne'er-Do-Wells. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their album The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Thanks to Richard Morrison for producing the show, and to Paul Turner of Amos and Bronwyn Frame of ERP for their support. This show and all past shows are available online at khoifm.org. Go to the Shows tab and click on Local Talk. Resource contact information is also listed. KHOI is a community radio station. Our mission is to build community through communication. If you have a community concern to share, please contact us through our website, khoifm.org, or call us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.